Hi, Prison Breakers. We're back. Hi, Paul.
Hello, Sarah. You're right.
Always right. About what am I right about?
Oh, the last episode, End of the Tunnel, was in fact the mid-season finale, as we call it.
Yeah, I wondered.
And this episode, The Rat, didn't air until March of 2006. End of the Tunnel aired in November of 2005. So
March?
Show kept fans waiting for 4 good long months.
It's a serious tease. I wonder what was going on in that time.
In the world or...
Wonder why. Was it like football that preempted us? Was it?
No, because football ends in...
Oh, right, with the Super Bowl in like
yeah,
February.
Yeah, and we were on Monday. Yeah, no, it wouldn't have been football. Monday? I think they just... I wonder what they put on. But I'll bet before they came back, and I think I do remember this from season one, they played the entire first 13.
Yes.
To get people caught up. I mean, even maybe in the time slot. That part I don't know.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, but, you know.
Yeah, big tease. Big tease. Okay, because there was no... Sorry, right. I'm fuzzing into my head on this one. They had to play it again because there was no DVD back then. There was no streaming to catch up on.
No on-demand, no Apple
TV. This was all like, apartment TV. Yeah.
If you wanted to get caught up on this show, you had to wait for them to show it.
That's a good point.
Crazy.
What do you think? Calstein Index?
Yes, please. Start us off.
Okay. This week's episode is The Rat, written by Matt Olmsted, directed by Kevin Hooks, who would go on to direct many episodes of the show.
Yes, our producing director.
It debuted, as Paul just said, March 20th, 2006, to 9.28 million viewers. It faced off against Wife Swap on ABC, it's new, King of Queens on CBS, and Deal or No Deal on NBC.
And now I just saw an ad that there is a Deal or No Deal Island.
Shut the front door.
Show, yeah. I don't even know what that means.
I don't know what that means
like
either.
It's like some Survivor Deal or No Deal combo. I don't know. It looks super intense and competitive and like people bleeding. The recap from imdb.com reads, "With the pipe to the infirmary replaced and Lincoln's life hanging in the balance, Michael must rethink his plan to escape and save his brother's life. A fellow inmate may hold the key to preventing Lincoln's execution."
Some of the things going on in the world that week. March 15th, the United Nations established the UN Human Rights Council to address human rights abuses globally. I wonder if one of those human rights abuses includes the death penalty. On March 28th, the Supreme Court of the United States heard arguments in Hamdan versus Rumsfeld, which asserted that the Bush administration's use of military tribunals to try detainees at Guantanamo Bay violated the Geneva Convention international law. And on March 26th, Scotland became the first part of the United Kingdom to ban smoking, in enclosed public spaces and workplaces.
In cultural news, March 12th saw the premiere of the final season of the show that changed it all, The Sopranos, on HBO. And on March 21st, 2006, Twitter creator Jack Dorsey launched the social media app with his tweet, "Just setting up my Twitter," Twitter spelled TWTR. He was really saving those 140 characters. That is quite a week, and I'm glad there's no more human rights violations in the world. That obviously worked.
Yep.
And Guantanamo has been shut down.
And Twitter was net good for humanity.
Yep. Everything's great.
I feel like, didn't an NFT of that first tweet sell for like $100,000 or something?
I mean, that tracks. I don't know, but it certainly wouldn't surprise me.
Here's what I really hope. I really hope that 5 years from now, someone finds this podcast and is listening and goes, "What's an NFT?" And that they've gone away. And that we never have to hear.
I may be wrong, but doesn't it feel like that kind of...
Already happened.
Am I wrong or is it just called something else now? Is it just...
I don't know. The NFT thing is bonkers to me. Okay, let's play folks our little edited version of our rewatch.
Yeah. So the people that didn't watch with us, you're going to hear some of our reactions to watching The Rat. Way more emotional music than we're normally getting on this show.
Yeah, I mean, they really do take the prospect of the electrocution very seriously. Yeah, it's interesting because Bellick seems to go from a power-hungry asshole to a buffoon And now we see him, like, we see his intelligence and his methodical machinations. That was a really beautiful moment of watching Wentworth go from vulnerability to putting the mask back on.
Mm. Holy God.
Dude, I'm like emotionally wrung out. I've been snotty weeping for the last three. I know, I'm so sorry. I'm glad that this is an audio only, so that people don't see this hot mess. Okay, that was an emotional gut punch. It like, that hurt my insides.
There's some real, for a show that kind of stays with the tension and with the drama and with the twists and turns, although there are those in this episode, it is really an emotional episode in just in terms of family and human connection and mortality.
Yeah, and a beautiful show debut for Kevin Hooks.
Yeah, you have some intense scenes in this episode, a whole series of them.
I feel like the whole episode is an intense scene. Everybody did such beautiful work.
Wow. Yeah. And Kevin Hooks, for a first episode, that is a adult dose to bite off, right? And you got to think that everybody, I mean, I'll ask you about this, but everybody has been playing to this, you know, has been acting towards, building towards this moment. Lincoln, Michael, Veronica, Sarah, you know, this has all been coming down the pike. And here we are.
And here we are.
I have lots of notes, lots of questions.
Great. Well, let's get it right into it after this.
Okay.
And we're back and better than ever. You said you took notes. I took notes too.
Lots and lots of notes.
Yeah.
Where do we start? The first thing I have on my notes, it just says fart. So let's not start with that. You made a fart joke when the guys are in the maintenance room and they're hiding. I said, "Don't fart." But, okay, but
I know. What a terrible thing to do. What a terrible way to minimize such a deeply emotional show.
I think you were trying to lighten the mood, which you did. I just want to go right to the scene with you and Michael and Link, where Michael says, "I want to see my brother." She says, "Can you talk to your father?" And you say, which is just such a great insight into Sarah and her whole presence in Fox River and her life growing up and everything. As you say, if I'm the one who's asking my father for clemency, he's much less likely to listen to it. It's just such a great line. It's so telling, and it's delivered really beautifully. I mean, you're so empathetic.
Thanks.
So empathetic with him, but nobody's pushing in these scenes. And the thing that I also love that they do it, if you mentioned it later, when Michael and Lincoln are saying goodbye, is there's not a lot of words for some of this stuff. For instance, when Michael says to you, "Can I talk to my brother? I want to talk to my brother." And you say, "I assumed it was going to be, you know, I can't do that." Then him saying, "Please." And then you saying, "Okay." It was just, you immediately say, "I'll try," which is says a lot about Sarah's kind of character and backbone. She knows it's outside of protocol, but she's going to do it anyway. Mm. And then you see him in one room. You see her walk to the other room, talk to the guard, and then you see Lincoln and Michael looking at each other through these two glass panes. You see Sarah through the glass pane. You never hear anything. You just know what's going on, and you see her kind of receive the news that it's not happening. And then her come back to Michael and say, "It's not happening."
Which keeps the focus where it belongs, which is on the relationship between the two brothers. You know what I mean? Like, I love the understanding from the writers. We don't need to hear Sarah say, "Please," and the guard say, "No," and her go, "No, really," and him goes, "No, I'm serious." All of that is secondary to the nonverbal conversation between these two brothers.
And I also think that I think one of the reasons this episode is so emotional is that all these protocols, shaving of the head, the last meal, the diaper, even the call from the governor, which is insane. There is this sense that there's a train on the tracks moving that is beyond your control.
There's an apparatus.
There's an apparatus in place. Nope, you don't get to see him now. You get to see him later. Nope, not until final visitation. Nope. But he's standing right there. Doesn't matter. Protocol is this. It makes the inevitability of the execution that much starker.
It feels like you've got to turn a battleship in order to change it. And You know, it's also interesting because just from like a procedural perspective, it also feels like part of what it does is it removes any capability from the human beings involved to make their own decision, right? It's a way of standing behind.
Purpose, that's right.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. Absolutely.
It's like the thing with firing squads where there's a...
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. With the blanks. There's a blank in one of the guns or there's a blank in all of the guns except one. I think it's the other.
I think it's that nobody knows. Yeah, it's designed so that nobody knows if they fired the kill shot.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I think really this episode more than any other, and I part of what I've always respected about the show is it does take very seriously the premise that this man could be put to death. Without that, you don't have a show, but like sometimes, you know, like it's easy to sort of play the end, which is they're going to get out and it's not that serious. This episode made it all feel very real. And it felt very real to me, partly because you go, oh, people do this. People sit in rooms with their last meal and their loved ones. And they say goodbye. And they walk their final steps on the earth. And that's interesting.
Yeah, to say the least. I think that one of the things that I was surprised by in revisiting it is that for a show that is, you know, we talked about it, it's a graphic novel, it's slightly heightened, it you know, it kind of exists out of time. It's certainly not political other than politics kind of being corrupt and dangerous at times, you know, with the vice president and money
and now the governor
and oil and now the governor. Yeah, now the governor being controlled by these interests. Well, I wouldn't say it is outright anti-death penalty, you're right that it could have avoided, much more easily avoided if it wanted to, really hitting home. Innocent people get killed. We know he didn't do it.
Yep.
And we know they're really trying hard to kill him. And it's not just because, you know, there's this evil conspiracy going on. I mean, Henry Pope is depicted as a good man with a conscience. And he's like, he says, I believe in the process.
Right.
And this is what the process says. Even
but
the
he's
judge
clearly
isn't,
someone who will put people to death.
Yes. And even the judge isn't monstrous. He says, no. This is all very compelling, but you're not really showing me anything. I can't stop this because that's what's been determined and I have no apparatus to stop it. And that's really chilling.
Especially on Fox. I mean, I know that Fox has become something different back and forth in many ways, and who knows where it is at this moment when people listen to this. But, you know, I mean, there's the Fox News emblem is on some of these microphones that the reporters are using. And to have a show whose very premise is an innocent man is going to be put to death by the state is fascinating. And also like, and I love it. I love that they didn't.
Oh, I do too.
Shy away from it, water it down.
Sorry, I interrupted. What were you saying?
No. Go, please.
One of the things I'm fascinated by in any kind of storytelling is when everybody knows he's not going to die.
Mm-hmm. Show's called Prison Break.
Right. He's not going to die. And to create that kind of emotion and tension, even when you know he's not going to die, is incredible. It always reminds me of Captain Phillips or another Tom Hanks movie, which I didn't see, where he lands the plane on the... It's like you know how these things end.
Sully.
Like they're real stories. You know how they end.
Absolutely.
And to be able to tell a story that creates tension and, you know, in this show, you're like, well, any TV viewer is like, well, they're not going to kill him. It's episode 14 or whatever. I mean, I guess they could, but you're pretty sure they're not going to, but you still get, the stakes are still raised so high with them saying goodbye to one another, the scene with LJ. Wait, why couldn't LJ be there?
Because
he's on like a house arrest or something?
No, because he's being framed for the murder of Lisa Ricks. So he'll be arrested if he's on the lam.
So he's on the run. He's on the lam. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And if he sets foot in the prison, they will arrest him.
Sure.
And then, of course, you will have a big bell and go gong and kill him. But two things about what you just said. So I think in some ways, that gravitas of taking it super seriously. Like, I mean, one, this was in a pre Game of Thrones, pre Walking Dead world where you didn't kill number one on the call sheet. And so in some ways, I wonder if in an interesting way, that security for the audience of knowing we don't know how he's going to get out of here, but it's like watching Houdini. You're not showing up to watch Houdini die. You're watching, you're showing up knowing that Houdini's going to escape, but you don't know how. But there's almost, it almost allows you, at least allows me, to emotionally invest a little deeper because I'm not worried that the show is going to crush me at the end of the 42 minutes.
The closer you get to the actual electric chair, you're like, oh my God, how are they going to stop this thing?
You're 100%. Yeah.
The fact that they took the time to have those emotional moments, I think a lot of shows would be like, they would do that during a montage. They would do it during, they would smash them all together because the audience doesn't have the patience for 90 seconds of that when they're like, we know he's not going to die. This somehow was really a gut punch. You really feel Michael's failure. You feel, you feel Veronica's failure. And with Lincoln, you really feel the despair. I mean, the thing where he says, just stop. I don't want to hope anymore. Stop giving me hope.
Enough already.
It's really touching. I wonder
about— And then
about,
the governor's call.
I mean, that was a little, I have to say, that seemed like cruel and unusual storytelling.
It really did.
Almost, in
a
way.
It really did.
Like, not unusual stuff, but like, really, they all stop and like, she has a smile on her face and he's just like, yeah, I reviewed it. It's not happening.
Yeah. I just called to tell you that you're still going to die. Like,
and the pad and the vice president reveal is good there. And to answer your question from a second ago, no, I don't remember how they get out of this.
I don't remember. Because it picks up. The next episode, if I'm not mistaken, if I'm remembering right, picks up like right there.
With him in the chair.
With him being strapped into the actual chair. I'm sorry, I don't know if it's the actual chair. I don't know what kind of research went into like, is this what the electric chair looks like? But, you know, they keep it going. And in some ways, I think structurally in the long view of the show, what's interesting is this is the only time you see it. Because, of course, he does get out. So there isn't a second execution where you would have all these scenes. This is kind of the shot at it.
Oh, that's interesting. You're starting from this place now, the second half of the season, let's say.
Yeah.
Where we get to see this. But by the time they're, you know, the last few episodes when they're actually about to escape, this is almost a thing of the past, right? I mean, it's not, it doesn't loom in the same way in my recollection. I might be wrong about that.
No, I think you're right. It is also, and we talked about this briefly, the only scene I have with Veronica.
I
where
mean,
I open about, a door.
Talk about not passing the Bechdel test.
And she's on the other side of it. Although I will say it, what was kind of funny is we were, you know, noticing this with each other. I was like, this is it, right? This is the only time we're going to see each other this season. And we decided while we were like hanging out shooting that scene, and I think it was the first time I met Frank Grillo. And I do remember we were on a stage and they had built that room and there was no reverse. Like,
right.
You could not look over my shoulder into the room because it was just, it was all plywood.
It was like two walls, right?
Yeah, it was, and they hadn't finished the outside of the wall. Yeah, so it was like, you're just going to stand here and open the door and that's going to be the whole shot. But she and I started talking and we're like, you know what? We should have a Christmas party. And there was this like,
oh my God.
Because we started talking about,
oh my God.
Wait, you guys are on your show. Paul's on his show. I'm in this, you know, romantic drama. And then the other guys are on their show. So let's have a Christmas party. And we did. We like made invitations and sent them to you guys thinking
and
like.
We went.
We had a Christmas. I think it was it at her house?
It was at her house or wherever she was staying in Chicago at the time. And it was about two blocks from my brother's where I was staying.
It was super close to you and me.
My girlfriend at the time, who then became my wife, who then became my ex-wife.
As you do.
We talk about that night all the time because it was kind of, she was in town. First of all, there was like 19 feet of snow on the ground. I don't know if you remember that.
We remember
sliding through the snow, probably on the way home, sliding through the snow and having a snowball fight on the way back to my brother's.
Aw.
But yeah, I remember that party being the first time everybody was kind of really together.
I also remember it being a little like, oh, hey, have you met so-and-so? Like, hey,
yes,
have you met, like, when we, and we'll talk about this later, but when we did get to the private room at the House of Blues celebrating the Golden Globes nomination, but that felt like old friends and celebration and woo woo. And this was like,
nice to meet you.
I wouldn't say church social, but there was a like.
There was. I remember
that
too.
I don't know all these people.
There's also a thing in Chicago. It also felt like a very adult. It felt very adult.
Mm-hmm.
Like I'm, and it's also, you know, it's freezing outside. It's hot inside. Everyone's wearing sweaters and standing around. Mm-hmm. Like it had a very Christmas party vibe.
It was not the, it felt very like an office Christmas party. It was,
That's
I will
right.
say this. It was
That's
not
exactly
the most successful
it.
Party I have ever thrown. And I remember being like, huh, okay.
You threw so, it? Oh, you and Robin threw it at Robin's.
Robin and I decided to, yeah, okay. to like have, you know, I just like, I remember my friend in New York had just started this business making like handmade greeting cards. And I was like, oh, I'll order a dozen of these and give them to the cat. You know, like it had this. And I remember the impulse of what if we all got together and became friends and could really blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, everyone gets together and you're like, well, there's a lot of us.
That's a lot of people, a lot of dynamics.
A lot of people to become a like, you know, kind of family and not many girls. Okay, what else do you have written down? Because I have something very silly and stupid written down.
I have rat written down, which is the name of the episode, but I wanted to talk about, you know, they tell you not to work with children and animals and they tell you really not to work with rats.
Oh, God.
I'm glad, so glad I wouldn't have to act with a rat.
Oh, God. You know,
Did Wentworth not like rats?
Does anyone like rats?
There are people that like rats.
Actually, that's true. You know, my very first thing I ever did on camera when we were in grad school, they farmed us out to do PSAs for various uh-huh. Denver area things. And mine was the Butterfly Pavilion. And I had to open my hands and there would be three different shots of three different creatures in there. I would say, it's at the Butterfly Pavilion. And one of them was a Mexican hissing cockroach. And one of them was a tarantula.
No.
And so I'm 20, maybe, getting paid $0. And they're like, okay, we're going to put the tarantula in your hand. Remain calm. And I was like, you've like defanged it and devenomed it, right? And they're like, yeah, that's not a thing. And I was like, sorry? They're like, we've got like, you know, we can handle this if it happens, but you can't like devenom a tarantula. And I was like,
oh my goodness.
Cool. So I'm just standing there with a tarantula in my hands, which by the way, they're very soft. It felt like somebody put a pile of Q-tips in my hand. It was very well behaved. I was not bitten.
Oh man. Okay. Okay. Moving on.
Okay.
Yeah. What was the little silly thing you wanted to talk about?
So there's this purse.
Oh, yeah.
This is the way that I had a real sense of what was happening with the show outside of Chicago in our little bubble. So there's this purse that I'm wearing in the scene with the governor. I think it's
your
the
father.
First time you
your
see,
father.
Yeah, asking for clemency for Lincoln. Just, you know, please just take a look at this file. I think in some ways it's the first time you see Sarah's really hopping on board on Team Lincoln. And I've got this purse over my shoulder. And I thought it was kind of cool. I wore it in every episode for the rest of the season that you saw me outside because I had a big thing about Sarah shouldn't have a big giant wardrobe, right? She doesn't have a ton of money. A few episodes with that bag aired. And a friend of mine was like, hey, that purse is really cute. Can you pick me one up? And I was like, okay. So I went to someplace in Chicago and I tried to find it. And they were like, oh, we don't have any. And I was like, all right. I was going down to New York the next weekend. So I went to New York. And this place that I knew sold that brand. And I went in. And she was like, no, we're all sold out. And I was
oh. It's incredible.
And Tano sold completely out
of
that bag. And I actually still have the original in my closet as we speak.
That's incredible.
And I got it. So one other thing that was interesting, I was noticing this kind of goes into the realm of us looking back at ourselves as slightly different people. And just bear with me because this is not me fishing for any kind of compliment or whatever.
I always do.
You're a champion.
I'm a fucking prince.
I appreciate you. So I put weight on during this season because Chicago is a great place to like drink red wine and have steaks.
and it's cold.
And I was somebody who was not particularly self-conscious about that. But I put weight on, and by this episode, I can see. And I remember looking in the mirror around these episodes going, oh God, I don't have cheekbones anymore. My face got round. And I remember it being a thing in my head that was really present.
Yeah.
And I now watch it and I go, I don't actually see a difference between the pilot. Uh-huh. And it's like, it's that crazy actor brain or maybe person brain or whatever.
I'm not proud to say that I still have it.
We're so hard on ourselves.
I saw this amazing interview. It's in the Paul Newman, Joanne Woodward documentary called The Last Movie Stars, which is really worth watching.
I've heard it's great.
Where in he's got to be in his 50s and still the most beautiful human to ever walk the earth. And he's talking to an acting class, maybe he's in his 60s, and they say, what's your greatest fear or something? And he says, without missing a beat, he says, that I'll wake up with brown eyes. And it's like, he had this incredible insecurity about being so beautiful.
Oh, interesting. That there's nowhere to go but down.
Well, no, that he felt like he wasn't the acting equivalent of his peers. I mean, he studied with Shelley Winters and Carl Malden and James Dean and Brando. Like, that was the class he was in at actor studio. So he always felt like he had gotten ahead with his looks more than his talent. So he had an insecurity about it. But I'm just wondering, like, are there people that aren't like, oof, look at my oof. I don't like the... And, you know, I saw Philip Seymour Hoffman say one of the things he was most proud of, or maybe he said glad, maybe proud wasn't the word. He said that very early on, he decided he wasn't going to care how he looked.
And I will say, you can't take your eyes off Phil Hoff.
Correct. And I wish I had done that.
And I really do believe that vanity is the enemy of art.
I agree, really. I mean, Jesus.
But it is so hard to dismantle. And what's interesting to me is, like, you know how you do interviews and they go, what would you say to your 20-year-old self? I was like, dude, no, shoot me in the face. I don't know what to say to that. I never have like a satisfying answer. For some reason, that question always annoys me. I watch this and I think I would sit her down and say, no one cares. There is not going to be, and look, part of it, I got to say, part of the fear was knowing there is a fandom out there watching and judging.
Not like you are.
I guess what I would just, you know, say to that young lady is like, it's they're not going to get mad at you. They're not going to not like you. They're not going to notice this. And it will only get in your way. But it's really interesting to go back in my head. I'm not watching these scenes being like, where the fuck are her cheekbones?
Right. I mean, I do it with myself still, but like, it's like, and then I'm like, but wait, just look at the work. And then sometimes I'm like, yeah, the work's not so good. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes I'm like, oh.
But that's wrong.
Okay, but sometimes it is.
I've been watching all of this with you. Your work's
okay,
great.
Sometimes it is. But you're going to have the same reactions.
No, you're
what
wrong.
I'm saying is what you said is the most important part, where it's not just that like vanity's bad for you, which it is. It's that it gets in the way of your work.
Yeah.
Like if you're sitting there I got to keep my whatever. This angle's better. I got to put my head this way. It's going to fuck you up. Mm-hmm. And if that's what you're thinking about before you go to
work. You're not thinking about the scene. Yeah.
It's going to fuck you. And you see actors. That's I also think that there is, I mean, we're going a little far afield here, but whatever. There's a lot of things when you're an actor, a lot of things that are beyond your control. Mm-hmm. In getting jobs, even when you have a job, you don't get to control how the day works. You don't get to control, are they going to shoot my side or their side first? You know, you don't get control over it's raining a little and now everyone's freaking out. Now there's horns honking out there. And, you know, there is only so much preparation you can do. There is actually a point, it's a different conversation, where you're doing too much work. Mm-hmm. Do your work at work. Mm-hmm. Don't do too much homework. Yep. You know, we can talk about all those things. I think what a lot of actors end up doing is putting that energy into...
Oh, appearance.
Even exercise, let's say, or food, or sleep, or getting vitamin D infusions, whatever it is, that there's this, you know, we are our instrument. That's an annoying thing to hear, but
totally
it is
true.
Absolutely true.
No, it's true.
And so I think people are like, well, this I can work every day. Mm-hmm. Instead of like learning.
Exercise control over this
correct.
One.
Instead
thing.
Of like, oh, I'm going to read more books or I'm going to learn a Shakespeare sonnet. They're saying, yeah, but I can run 10 miles a day and I can do this and I can do that and then I'll be. Mm-hmm. And that can be mm-hmm. super effective, obviously, and super healthy, but like everything, too much of a good thing.
And, you know, for any actor out there listening, my personal philosophy, and listen, you take that with a grain of salt that my career is what
salt,
it is.
Salt what it is will it. Make you puffy, though. So maybe take it with a grain.
Take it with a grain of sodium-free.
Sodium-free something.
Soy sauce? Okay.
Yeah, there you go.
If you have the choice between honesty and vanity, choose honesty every time, for the love of God. Because I will say, and I think this is probably true of both of us, there will always be somebody cuter.
That's right.
There will always be someone fitter. The jobs I get are the jobs that I beat other people in the audition room. You know what I mean?
Think like that's right. I do. I think that's right.
I believed her audition.
And all this.
I believed
all this,
her audition instead of. I feel like I'm on a soapbox. I'm getting down.
No, I'm not proud to say that all these years into my career, I still need to hear that. All right, we could go on and on and on.
Yeah, but and we have.
Yeah.
But we should go off and off and off.
Okay, let's.
Break? Yeah, fan questions?
Yeah, quick break, and then we'll be back with some fan questions. Let's do it.
Welcome back, everyone.
Hello.
Paul's got a couple of questions for us.
All right, these come from Instagram. The first one is from Long Story Short with 3 T's and an what's it called? Underscore?
Underscore.
It's from Long Story Short.
Handle.
Underscore. Did they actually film in Chicago when they weren't in the prison scenes? And the answer is yes. And I think to great effect. I mean, in this episode that we just watched, The Rat, mm-hmm. there's a really cool tracking shot across either Michigan Avenue or Wabash. Looks like in the middle of the day with lots of traffic. And that is super impressive. And it gives...
Yeah.
I think it really lends a lot to the show because it's a stark contrast between Fox River and then this bustling city. And mm-hmm. most of the time when you're in the bustling city, you really get a sense of the power. You know, you're in the corridors of power. You're in the courtroom. You're in the governor's whatever office.
The governor's yeah, wherever
mansion office.
We are where we shot that.
Yeah, I don't know what building that is. It's not the State of Illinois building, yeah. but it's certainly grand.
No, but the rotunda up there
yeah, amazing.
Absolutely and then spectacular.
In the courtroom scene where Veronica and Nick are making their plea, I remember for some reason I was there that day. I don't know why, but that was... some big grand room too, and you could, like you said, listen to the echo. Like you can hear, echo.
And
that.
They kept
and so,
it,
yeah, they really
great.
Used Chicago well.
Okay, next question
from Pepe underscore Oliver underscore Bell. Did any of the mm-hmm. characters' backstory change significantly in the process of creating it? Did any of the characters' backstory change significantly in the process of creating it? That's a really good question for a writer. That we should have and get into at some point. I know that we have an episode called Brothers Keeper coming up, which has tons of backstories
yes, we
in it.
Do.
And one of the interesting things, I mean, Sarah, you could talk about this. I don't know how much you knew about Sarah's backstory when you started. I certainly didn't really. I made my own backstory up for Kellerman. And then when it slowly started to get revealed, one of the writers asked me, what did you come up with? And then they said, we're thinking about this and this and this. And I said, oh, that's great. And then I would use that. But mm-hmm. a lot of times you make up your backstory and then you find out that it's different and you just kind of adjust. How much did you know about Sarah before you started?
Well, I mean, I think we talked about this in early episodes. I made up a bunch of stuff, shared some of it with the writers, and then it ended up landing. The Brothers Keeper episode was a giant set of, oh, wow. And I think I think it's really common in television to backfill and go, okay, wait, like the C-note backstory to me is one of the most fascinating because you get to know him as a very smart, somewhat conniving inmate. And then you realize, he's got a wife and a kid who think that he's overseas serving in Kuwait.
So great.
I think it's really...
But it's unlikely
beautiful.
That Rockman knew that before he started, right?
I think it's unlikely that Paul Schering before he started.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, great question. We will get way more into this with our guest, Greg Yatanis, who directed Brother's Keeper mm-hmm. in just a couple episodes.
I think we're running out of time.
Right. Yeah, I think that does it for another episode of Prison Breaking with Sarah and Paul.
Yes.
Please come follow our Instagram at Prison Break Podcast, and that way you can be a part of some of our competitions and leave fan questions.
Yeah, and don't forget to call into the Prison Breaking Hotline at 4013-P-BREAK, 4013-P-BREAK.
That's the letter P.
Yeah, it's every time.
Okay, so I made a fart joke. I got to end with a fart joke. So what do we want to ask the people this week? What if it's something about like Bellick and his, are you pro dipping your fries?
Oh, there you go. Okay, so call us at the Prison Breaking Hotline at 4013-P-BREAK and tell us when you're eating fries and a burger and a milkshake, do you dip the fries in the milkshake or not? And is that regional?
Watching it.
Some people are like, oh, that's a Chicago. I was like, that's not a Chicago thing. It might be a thing, but I don't think it's specifically a Chicago thing. So call up and give us your questions. Give us your comments.
Tell us about your burgers and fries questions.
Yes.
And if you throw in something in there about a rat bonus, we'll come up with something better next week, you guys. Okay. So, credits?
Hit me.
Prison Breaking with Sarah and Paul is a Caliber Studio production.
Your hosts have been friends, but not besties, Sarah Wayne Kellis and Paul Edelstein.
Our prison warden has been producer Ben Haber.
Keeping us slim and trim in the prison yard has been sound designer and editor Jeff Schmidt.
Keeping us up to date on the outside world is production assistant Drew Austin.
Letting the world know what's been happening to us in prison is social media manager Emma Tolkien.
Our prison tunes were written and recorded by the one and only Paul Edelstein.
Our prison artist, logo, and brand designer is John Nunziato at Little Big Brands. Check them out at www.littlebigbrands.com.
Follow us on Instagram at Prison Break Podcast. Email us at pbpodcast@caliber-studio.com or call us at 401-3-PBREAK.
Prison Breaking with Sarah and Paul is a Caliber Studio production. Your hosts have been friends, but not besties, Sarah Wayne Callis and Paul Edelstein. The prison warden has been producer Ben Haber. Keeping us slim and trim in the prison yard has been sound designer and editor Jeff Schmidt. Keeping us up to date on the outside world is production assistant Drew Austin. Letting the world know what's been happening to us, our music was done by Paul Edelstein. Our prison artist, logo, and brand designer is John Nunziato and Little Big Brands. Check him out at www.littlebigbrands.com. Follow us on Instagram, Prison Break Podcast. Email us at prisonbreaking@caliberstudio.com and call us at 401-3-P-BREAK. Prison Breaking with Sarah and Paul has been a Caliber Studio production. Thank you for listening.